You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last week marked the 150th anniversary of Frank Lloyd Wright's birth, and to celebrate, the Museum of Modern Art has unveiled an exhibition of his drawings, architectural models, and other materials found in the archives that they acquired 5 years ago, along with Columbia University. The show is called Frank Lloyd Wright at 150, Unpacking the Archive, and it's on view at MoMA until October 1st. I'm pleased to welcome Barry Bergdahl, Curator of Architecture and Design at MoMA, and Professor of Art History and Archaeology at Columbia University. He's here with Jennifer Gray, the Project Research Assistant, I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hi.
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 Barry, how did the Wright Archives wind up in New York, and why did MoMA and Columbia, rather than the Guggenheim, team up to acquire them?
It's a long story, but I think to cut to the chase, a number of years ago, the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, which cataloged and cared for these drawings for years, they were used partly to continue Wright's practice, partly to train the students at Taliesin, which is still a going architecture school and community, and had become, of course, a major resource for scholars. They realized that they needed to build a better facility for it and did an analysis and were looking around for another arrangement. And I received a phone call asking if the Museum of Modern Art would be interested in housing this vast archive, as it turned out, two tractor trailers worth of materials.
And they couldn't have stayed at the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation in Arizona?
I think they felt they needed to make choices. They run a property, they run a school, they were running an archive, and they were looking for someone to make the archive more accessible. We were terrified by the notion of what would it mean if all of the Frank Lloyd Wright scholars and house owners and fans wanted to come and consult these drawings at the Museum of Modern Art. And so we turned to the Avery Architectural Library for this partnership library museum.
And you're at Columbia and at MoMA, so it's logical. But where will it actually be housed, in both institutions?
It is in both institutions, sort of dividing competences. The paper-based material, which is the lion's share of it, is at Columbia University, and that means that people who need to see it or want to see it have accessibility through the library, and it's part of an archive that's already long established there. The three-dimensional materials, the models, the building fragments, and we hope in the future these amazing films that came with it will reside at MoMA, because those are things that MoMA collects.
Jennifer, are all of his architectural drawings there? We're talking about something like 50,000 drawings?
Not all, because some were purchased by other people earlier before we acquired the archive, but the vast majority are. There are still some drawings at Taliesin from the TAA, Taliesin Associate Architects, but the vast majority is at Avery now.
And then there are 125,000 photographs?
Mm-hmm.
300,000 pieces of correspondence?
Mm-hmm.
So this has got to be a serious sorting and cataloging job.
Mm-hmm. It definitely is. The numbers keep being revised upward as the collection's being processed. Even just, you know, a few weeks before we open the exhibition, I'm finding new photographs that were put in the wrong box and we didn't know they were there, and we're kind of adding them in last minute. So it's still a process of discovery and unpacking, if you will.
And how do you go about planning an exhibition from that kind of, that quantity of material?
It was daunting, not only because the material is so enormous, but also the figure is so well known. So to add another sublime statistic, I think if you look in the Avery catalog of the Avery Architectural Library, which is one of the most complete architecture libraries in the world, there are over 800 books, not counting articles, 800 books on Frank Lloyd Wright. If you go into any architecture bookshop, W is the biggest section. So no one can even read them all in a certain sense.
More but about him than any other architect?
Absolutely,
by far. Even more than Le Corbusier?
Well, probably Le Corbusier is a good rival, and indeed they were rivals through their lives. So the challenge for us was, how do you find something new to say with this vast archive? How do you find something new to say about Frank Lloyd Wright? We would walk out on the street now and say to somebody, name an architect. I bet you 90% of the time you'd hear Frank Lloyd Wright.
He designed more than 1,000 buildings. How many of them were actually built?
In the high 400s, so just under 500, which is a huge ratio of built projects to unrealized projects.
And in the show, there are models and drawings from many projects that were never realized.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at some of them, do you wish that they had been?
Yeah, of course. There's some amazing all kinds of complexes. Sugarloaf Mountain is a planetarium slash viewing platform in a sense. It's an inverted Guggenheim. To have something like that be built would be, you know, amazing. So there's all kinds of fantastical urban projects, skyscrapers.
Others are terrifying. We conceived the exhibition to invite 14 different people to work on one intriguing object. So some people developed a love affair with that object. Other people developed an intellectual curiosity. I developed a fascination with this project for a mile-high skyscraper, but I can't say that I would love to see it love to see it built.
His idea for the mile-high skyscraper was that you'd put everything, all the businesses, into that, and then you could just take the rest of New York City and have one single-family homes.
It was partly that. For a long time, it was actually proposed for Chicago, although there was no client and not a real site. And he did want to put all of the government offices of Illinois, of Cook County, of the city of Chicago into the tower. But that left a lot of other space left over, which he thought would be shops and parking. And then he thought that the whole top of it would be television studios, and so that one would broadcast nationwide from the highest point in the country.
It's been said that he's more popular among the public than among architects. So who's looking at these things? Are architects looking at them? Are they still being inspired by Wright?
I think they are. And I think that one thing we've discovered at the museum with architecture exhibitions is that architectural drawings, on the one hand, are difficult of access for the general public. In this particular case, we've produced videos with each of the guest curators who are unpacking one object. So there are guides along the way and ways to help get the public into viewing these drawings. But architects today design so much on computer that I think there's a nostalgia for drawings, and they immediately engage with the graphic talent of someone like Wright and his team.
In the old days, often assistants did the drawings. Do we know how many of these drawings were by Wright's hand?
We don't know, and I would wager that the vast majority of them are not by Wright's hand. If there's 56,000 drawings, he didn't draw all of them himself. There has been research trying to determine who drew which drawings, and in some cases we can determine that. Sometimes they're signed, but usually it's a mixture of looking at oral histories and interviews and things like this. So that's a probably undoable project to identify every single one, but there is some starting points there that we've uncovered.
The exhibition is not really a full retrospective of his career. Did you want to look at some of his lesser known works rather than just sticking to the greatest hits?
For sure. We invited people to go play in the archive for a while, see if they found something that intrigued them. We invited people who have not studied Wright before because we wanted fresh points of view. We wanted unexpected aspects of Wright's career to come out. And we also wanted to announce the archive is here in New York City. It's available. You don't have to have Wright credentials in order to make a discovery there. And so some people picked relatively minor works, but virtually unknown. One for a model designed for school for African-American children in the South is virtually unknown. Who knew of this aspect of Wright's work in the 1920s? Or, for that matter, even though some 5,000 of them were built, who knew about, at least I did not until this recent film, about the Rosenwald School program in the teens and 20s.
So there were lots of surprises.
Many surprises, and I think there are many more. One has a sense that the archive, as much as it's been farmed over the years, still has lurking in many places unexpected discoveries, and that one doesn't have to simply work from the most famous of the buildings. You get a new angle on Wright by taking the lesser-known work.
My guests are Barry Bergdahl, curator of architecture and design at the Museum of Modern Art, also the Meyer Shapiro Professor of Art History and Archaeology at Columbia University, and Jennifer Gray, the Project Research Assistant in the Department of Architecture and Design at the Museum of Modern Art. The show's divided into 12 sections, each centered on a key object from the archives. Who chose those objects?
The guest scholars did, and in some cases we worked very closely with them. I mean, some people had an idea of a topic they wanted to approach. Others had something really broad, like ornament. Frank would write an ornament. You could pick almost any drawing, and it could be a key object. So there was oftentimes research that we would do together to kind of come to a place as a point of departure.
And your section with Therese O'Malley of the National Gallery is called Ecologies and Landscapes, and it focuses on a drawing called the Floricycle?
Mm-hmm.
What's that?
This is a planting plan for the Darwin Martin House in Buffalo, New York. And as far as we've been able to determine, it's only been published one time in the preservation reports produced by the Darwin Martin House. So it's not a very well-known drawing. And essentially, it details every single plant that would have been planted in this half circle hemicycle, it was called the flora cycle, and how to care for it, where they would come from. So it's a highly detailed planting list that allowed us to really do an investigation into what would have been in the garden versus speculating. And one of the big discoveries we made is that many of the plants were foreign species that would have had to be imported or were acculturated to our environment. So it raised a lot of questions about Wright's loyalty to indigenous local environments.
In fact, gardeners today might be horrified. Was he especially interested in landscape architecture? Did he design gardens for many of his house?
He often collaborated with landscape architects like Walter Burley Griffin or Jens Jensen, and we actually included some archival material from those archives to put Frank Lloyd Wright in context. So I think that he was very interested in landscape design. He's certainly interested in environmental planning, where he's more building infrastructures and things like this into the landscape. But in terms of him designing gardens, I think he actually often collaborated with others to design.
And then there's another section that focuses on Little Farms Unit from 1932 to 1933. A kind of experimental farm community? Is that inspired by the Depression?
It falls into the Depression. The work begins right before the Depression with an absolutely fascinating figure who I think comes to light for the first time in this exhibition with our colleague Juliet Kinchin's study of this amazing model for what Wright called a little farm unit. The project continues into the Depression, and it's a seed, really, for Frank Lloyd Wright's complete rethinking about the way that we build cities, the way that we live on the land in the 1930s. And so in the midst of the Depression and then in the Dust Bowl, Wright becomes a key and interesting voice in the debate over where should our food come from? Should we grow it locally? Should it all be shipped from the Central Valley in California? He even goes to the Soviet Union and witnesses collectivized farms. Mm-hmm. What we debate now with the locavore issue is a big issue already in the 30s, and it turns out Wright was a key voice in it.
I'm a big admirer of Mies van der Rohe, but I can't imagine him ever doing anything like that.
Well, he did design a drive-in restaurant, Mies, which is very surprising.
There's also a section about the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo. Was that one of the projects that made him internationally famous?
Yes, I would say so. The Imperial Hotel was his largest project to date when he constructed it in the late teens, early 20s, and it famously survived the Great Kanto earthquake of September 1st, 1923. So that alone, I think, really skyrocketed Wright in that particular building into, you know, global knowledge. But then, of course, afterwards, he designs many other projects, Falling Water and whatnot, but it was certainly a seminal make-or-break moment for him.
Although you could say that the one surprising thing about Frank Lloyd Wright is he himself acknowledged he was much more appreciated after his first decade of practice in Europe, particularly in Germany and in the Netherlands, than outside the Midwest. Through his publication of what's known as the Wasmuth Portfolio, he had a huge impact on European architects, Mies van der Rohe for one, long before he achieved the fame that we associate with him in later years.
There's an area devoted to ornament in his work, including textiles, mosaics, murals, and other decorative elements. Didn't many modernist architects try to eliminate ornamentation in their work?
That was the most fun thing. We got to write the word in large letters, ornament, on the walls of the Museum of Modern Art. So even though it's well known that Frank Lloyd Wright was interested in ornamental motifs, somehow to declare in the Museum of Modern Art that the abolition of ornament is not the only root of modernism, I think raises one of many provocative questions to think about. What is Wright's relationship to modern culture?
There are several architectural models for buildings, and you have a section about conservation of those models. Do they present special problems for conservators?
Yes, because the materials are so fragile. It's cardboard, adhesive that becomes dry over time and doesn't work anymore.
And we're talking about things that are 75 to 100 years old.
Yes, yes. The model for St. Mark's, there's two models that were restored, the Guggenheim model and St. Mark's. St. Mark's, by far, it was on life support, basically, when it arrived at MoMA. And so the conservators actually made a decision to leave a quarter of it in its found state. They cleaned it and stabilized it, but they only restored three quarters of it. So you actually get this moment where you can compare its own history and how it ended up 90 years later after it was made and the restoration process.
One of the major things we tried to do in this exhibition, which is a bit challenging, as much as architectural exhibitions are always challenging, I think, for the public, and to think of how to engage people with buildings that aren't there, we created videos, 14 of them, one for each section of the show, on the behind the scenes, the process, the thought process. Each of the scholars was filmed in the archives at Columbia University working with the drawings, but the model conservator was filmed during the process of conserving the model and the discussions that we had about what should we do, how do we understand what went on here. This model is a very sick patient. How do we bring it back to life in a way that makes it exhibitable? And I think that's one of the most engaging things for the public is there are these behind-the-scene perceptions through the videos that are part of the show.
There's a model of the Guggenheim, and the color was originally quite different than it is now. What color did Wright want it to be?
It was more of an ochre beige, so quite a bit darker. And they discovered this through paint analysis. And the actual Guggenheim building itself was also a darker kind of ochre beige color, and it's been lightened up over time. And in the case of that model, it was in very good shape, good condition. So they did a virtual restoration and put it back into its original color, but they didn't repaint the actual model.
But it's extraordinary because this model is a model for an earlier phase of the Guggenheim. It's not the Guggenheim as built. People who know that famous building will think that there's something the matter with their vision because the two rotundas are flipped in the early version. I keep wondering if Fifth Avenue maybe changed its direction, but ultimately the rotunda moved to the other side of the site. And yet, even though this model is not of the model of the building as built, it too was updated as the Guggenheim got whiter over the years, so too did this model.
Do you see a lot of adjustments in the buildings from the original conception, the drawing, the model, to
yes.
the actual building?
Because he's exhibiting them over the course of his St. Mark's, traveled all over Europe, but traveled over the United States, so he uses them as part of his curatorial kind of strategies, and so he changes and updates them as his own ideas change, so he's always exhibiting the most up-to-date idea.
You said new stuff is turning up all the time. This exhibit is scheduled to be on view at the Museum of Modern Art until October 1st. Will you be adding things along the way?
Oh, gosh, I think we'd probably get in a lot of trouble if we kept adding more things.
We'll be adding more ideas since the archive is here now in New York, so we hope to develop many other ideas in future years. I should say that there's a small exhibition centered around the Broadacre model, which is extraordinary, that will open at the new art gallery at Columbia University in the fall. So that's that's going to be added, a whole other module to the show, opens in mid-September through December.
And meanwhile, we also have a wonderful catalog under the same title, Frank Lloyd Wright, Unpacking the Archive. My great thanks to Barry Bergdahl and Jennifer Gray for being on our show today to talk about the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.